I just don't ever want you to ever feel shame or like any guilt or anything like that. So I guess my vulnerable question for you is that ever a struggle for you?
How low can I go when the only thing I know is trying to love you? And kind of feel like I'm low for something. Well, you know,
and it breaks my heart. My heart goes out to people who are in that space. So it's pretty hard to turn people away, you know, when they're at that time.
I never thought Joey's not coming out of this. So when you think about your job, I was always thinking, how can we remove stress to get Joey better? And then when Joey's better, like whether it's the same job you were in at that point or a different job, like it was like, we'll figure out what Joey's job looks like. That's the least of our concerns right now.
You were very like bravely unafraid to stand with us. I will say, when you go through something that looks that scary, because he didn't, you know, he didn't look like him. You guys saw somebody like something else.
If I had like a single word that would summarize what I feel like I'm supposed to do with my life, it's to help people be hopeful about the future. And it wouldn't work with you. It's frustrating because I'm like, you would talk about the house and your job and supporting the family, and I would be like, Joey, you're not losing your job.
Like, well, God's bigger than everything. And it's like,
yes,
yeah, but your brain can't process God correctly.
Well, and that he actually uses modern medicine to heal people. And honestly, I do remember talking with the executive group and just saying, let's not let him go back too soon.
There's different environments where you do feel like you have to hide more, which is unfortunate, which needs to change. And so not very many big churches similar to Seacoast, I don't know if people would feel as safe.
So most of you are aware that in 2019, I went through a mental health crisis that spanned over the time of a good 5 months. We started telling this story, Priscilla and I, last year. I'll have those episodes in the show notes if you wanted to start there. So we, with the help of my dad, friends, a pastor, and therapist friend of ours, simply wanted to share the different experiences, the different perspectives of other people that were in our lives, our perspectives, our experiences, things that we learned, honestly, for the purpose of solidarity for others who struggle in this capacity. There's just something about knowing that someone else understands the struggles that you go through. So today we talk about various friends, specifically Josh and Lisa Surratt, who are lead pastors of our church, dear friends, our pastors, and they were there for us in the darkest, darkest of times. So this conversation is with them and centers around that time and our relationship with them. But before we do that the story and the conversations that we talk about with Josh and Lisa, we're talking September of 2019, pre-going into the hospital. Well, after getting out of the hospital, I actually had, a couple of weeks later, probably the worst week of my life. One of those days, or a couple of those days, maybe three. The number keeps growing, in which I was suicidal. And one of those days, I talked to someone named Brian McLaren, who was a very, very kind man, offering me a whole lot of his time because he knew that I was in desperate need of that time. And so I want to play a quick recording of a conversation that I had recently with Mr. Brian McLaren about that conversation that we had on the phone as I was in the pits of despair. Here you go.
So I think I told you this, Brian, but I talked to you on the phone. I would consider one out of the three worst days of my life. I remember basically what happened was I was already in a major, major mental health crisis, and kind of the low hanging fruit for me when it comes to this sort of thing is the spiritual stuff is always very problematic. Yeah. Like I revert back to the legalism, the constant praying salvation. Yeah. I mean, just everything goes back. And I remember I should not have done this, and it's crazy. Now being on the other side of this, I talk to people who are in the same situation, and I was like, I know that you're going to have a hard time doing this, but just stay away from everything spiritual right now. Like, you don't need to be reading your Bible. You don't need to be like asking these tough questions and everything, because your mind just can't process it well, and it's what's causing your problems. But with really bad judgment, I decided that I was going to read through one of the Gospels, and I was reading through them, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, Jesus seems really, really mean. He seems like really judgmental. Like, if you don't forgive others, I won't forgive you. And if you deny me, I'll deny you. And just on and on and on and on. I was like, oh my gosh. It was so compounding that with the fact that I was already struggling. I texted you, and I'll say an official, I'm sorry for doing that to you. I texted you, and I was like, I could probably find the text, but I'm in trouble. I don't know what to do. I'm reading the Gospels, and it's killing me. I'm curious, man. Like, you're a busy guy, and you and I have developed a casual friendship over podcasting, but it's, you know, we're not super tight friends, and we don't have that sort of relationship. Like, why did you decide, hey, Joey, let's try to talk the next day? Because you can't do that with everyone.
Yeah, you know, Joey, I guess a couple things. First, I was a pastor for 24 years, and so through the years, I had so many people in mental health crisis, and it breaks my heart. My heart goes out to people who are in that space. So it's pretty hard to turn people away, you know, when they're at that time. But at the same time, it's a little frustrating, as you know, because you also know anything you say at that time will be filtered through whether it's depression, or mania, or paranoia, or whatever that a person's experiencing. So I feel the tension of that, but it just doesn't seem right to walk to the other side of the road.
Totally. And you actually told me that, like, going into the conversation, you said that, Joey, you have got to take into consideration that everything that you are thinking, everything that you're reading is being filtered through these grossly unhealthy lenses. And you're so right. Like, I don't think I believe
you. No,
like,
you can't. Yeah.
I don't think I had the capacity to believe you, you know? And so you literally, and I have sang your praises to so many different people because I just want to do that on the airwaves, and you're probably sick of me thanking you, but you literally gave me like an hour and a half, 2 hours of your time as we just combed through these problematic verses. We ended up doing a whole podcast episode on those verses, but you were there for me in a time of need, and I really do appreciate it.
I'm so glad you've come through so well, Joey. I remember one of the first times I had to deal with this. I was a young pastor. I was younger than you are now, probably. And our church had a retreat, And this fellow who was a year or two older than me was sitting outside. He wouldn't go inside. I went out to talk to him. And I didn't understand mental health issues, but he was certain that Bob Dylan was talking to him. And and I just remember I got a big education that night, realizing you know, that there was nothing I could say that could get through. And I had very little understanding of mental health issues. It turns out in the years since, you know, members of my family who, you know, very close family members and dear friends have suffered with different kinds of mental illness. So it's something that, you know, sometimes people's religion makes them way worse off, both when they're suffering from mental illness or when they're trying to help other people because they just start quoting Bible verses or whatever else. And it doesn't really help.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was interesting is I literally remember, okay, I'm talking to Brian McLaren here at 2 o'clock. It's not going to do any good, but I need to just keep this commitment. I'm desperate. I'm hoping against all hope. And even though getting off the phone with you did not get me out of that state of mind, like literally hearing your explanations for those verses, it almost gave me some hope that, okay, all hope is not lost here.
That's encouraging to know.
Do you remember coming to James Allen offices?
Yeah, I remember coming
and
to
then,
there.
I feel like I'm jumping all over the place, so you can redirect if you want, but I remember when you called me, I was downstairs in our kitchen and my phone said Josh the Rat. And because I don't remember where you were, I don't know if you were staying with your parents, but for some reason, as soon as I saw your name, I just was like, oh my God, like what happened to Joey? And I was like, how, now that I think about it, I'm like, why wouldn't my mom or my sister call me? Like, why would I think Josh the Rat's going to deliver me bad news or something? But it's just like you and I don't call each other. So that felt...
Yeah. So I was thinking about the timeline with Josh and Lisa Surratt. And I think the very first thing was I was actually at the Mount Pleasant campus for a prayer service for the staff. And a woman that we were working with at the time had talked to you, Jennifer. She had talked to you and she wanted to make sure you knew, hey, this, what's been happening is serious sort of thing. And so you and I sat at a table and this is what you always forget. You always forget that I had like a reprieve between the first half and the second half because it all just blends in with her, but you can attest to it. I mean, I'm sitting there with you and I said, I'm just hoping that it's over. And I was fine. Yeah. Like I felt like I was still kind of coming out of it, but the worst part was over. And I remember you saying, yeah, I'm going to believe that.
Yeah. And, well, and I thought that. I thought from what Jennifer, I'm sorry, from what this person that.
No, I said
you,
Jennifer. That's fine. That's
okay,
fine.
Good. Yeah. From what she shared with me, I realized, wow, this, I did not know that this was as serious as it was. Because at that point, I had heard through a couple of our other staff members that you were struggling, but I did not know that you were in a really, really rough place.
Right.
And then when I met with you, I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, Joey's. He's doing better.
Right.
And it seems like the cloud is lifting a little bit.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, I thought we're moving back towards stuff's balancing out and you're going to get back to yourself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was probably in August.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think so. I think it was August.
September that I had the phone call with Priscilla.
Right.
And it was like, things are not good.
Right. So the phone call you're talking about, Priscilla, so I was at my parents' house, and I mean, it was when I started to fall again, and it was really bad, and I just felt like my parents knew, you knew, and it's weird. There is like, I got to a point where I didn't even have the energy to do this, but at that point there was like a sense of comfort just to know that you knew. And I think it was Chip. And I think even Pastor Greg, I think I texted maybe you three, maybe Sam too, but
it was us three and Jack.
And Jack. Okay. Gotcha.
Well, and I remember, us sitting at the with our executive group, and I don't know if it was you or Jack, you know, brought up like, hey, Joey's in trouble. And I just remember having this like, wait, we have to go today. Today we have to go. And I remember it was like, you know, just because at that point we had just heard about so many, you know, pastors at that point who just hit the wall and nobody knew. And we knew. And so at that point we were like, this isn't an option. We're going today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And on one hand, it felt like everybody was just going on as business as usual. And I was the one that brought it up. I was like, guys, we've got to talk about this. And it was a small group of people. I was like, we've got to talk about this because we've got to help him. I had just come home from a 40th birthday celebration on which I found out that a friend of yours and someone that I had admired had taken his life.
Yeah,
so
Jared.
I think it was like, wow, yeah, this is something we've got to address. And I think it was probably that day or within a day or two that we ended up coming to meet with you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That I remember where I was sitting, and it's weird too, because when you go through the sort of thing that I went through, I did have some windows of, oh my gosh, it's a relief. I'm not feeling as bad. And I remember sitting in mom and dad's chair and seeing that Jared had committed suicide. And it was just surreal because I was living in the sort of mess that causes people to do that. And here, and it's weird because Jared and I weren't close. We were like text friends, but it does not matter. Like, it's like when you hear about something like that, automatically you're like, I wish I would have just texted him 2 days ago mm-hmm. and just to check in, you know? I mean, you just have that. But it was surreal because I felt like I was in the middle of that, and then a guy that I knew killed himself. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Priscilla and I had our conversation on the phone.
Yeah, so when I texted you guys, that's when you called her.
I called Priscilla. I don't know if I told you where I was when I called you.
I can't remember.
On the toilet?
I was on a beach in Hawaii.
Oh, that's right.
And it was maybe 4 days before Jared took his own life. And we talked for a long time. I don't know how long it was, but we talked for a really long time. And that's when I realized, okay, we're going to get home and we're gonna find a way to help you. And
I didn't crash y'all's Hawaii trip, did I?
You did.
Oh, sorry. Did
y'all come back early?
No.
I was like, what?
We love you, Joey, but we did not come back early.
It's like, we might have to redo that trip. That's funny.
So do you remember like the conversation? Because you had told me also, I mean, you said like Josh was like in almost problem solve role. Like, I mean, do we need to change his job? I mean, do we need to do just like...
Oh, when you say that, it does... remind me. Sometimes I wish I wrote stuff down, but I'm too afraid to go back and sit in that space. But yeah, I would say we had a very candid conversation, kind of even about the wrestling Joey and I have done in different places that maybe weren't so pretty as far as where we were at. And then how just, I know it sounds kind of cheesy, but you were just like, you had a lot of care and concern and kindness in your voice. It had nothing. I mean, it's, you say problem solving, but you were in a mode of like, what do we need to do?
Well,
like, what needs to happen?
Yeah.
Who cares about whatever any of this was? Like, now we just need to figure out what you need.
I was trying to figure out what was stressing Joey.
Yeah.
And could we remove any of that stuff? Mm-hmm. And I was wanting to reassure you that we aren't going to like fire Joey. We're not like, I was trying to figure out and the whole journey, like, and we'll get to other places that we got to. I never thought Joey's not coming out of this. So when you think about your job, I was always thinking, how can we remove stress to get Joey better? And then when Joey's better, like, whether it's the same job you were in at that point or a different job, like, it was like, we'll figure out what Joey's job looks like. That's the least of our concerns right now. Let's figure out how can we take stuff away from Joey that might help him not carry the stress that he's carrying. And
there wasn't ever even a remote thought in my head that that God wasn't going to heal you.
No.
Yeah, you could feel that. And I would say, again, when you guys came in, you and I were talking because you were with your parents. And
even what led up to meeting with them in the office is like, I don't even really recall. Like, that's how gone I was. Like, I think I remember hearing about it and I was like, okay, I don't know when that is. And then I think I remember maybe my parents took me to the office and I was like, oh, that's when it's going to happen. I think I wore sunglasses. Did I wear sunglasses? Did I sit on that couch?
You were naked.
I was naked.
It was really uncomfortable. Oh,
shoot. I'm sorry, Lisa. Lisa, I'm sorry.
You were naked.
No, you did have sunglasses. And I think it was Lisa and Priscilla had talked after our executive group meeting. And I think, if I know my wife very well, she insisted that we were going to do this, like, now.
So you're an 8 on the Enneagram? I mean, like, the perfect combination of, like, deep care and concern and a lot of authority and confidence, and we're doing this. Like, this is going to be okay, and this is what you need to do. And I cannot tell you how I felt like it kind of gave me some strength. Like, I didn't feel alone anymore. You know what I mean? Not that I felt alone, because we talked about Jennifer. She was such a good friend through that. And my sister was amazing. I mean, I definitely had some amazing friends surrounding me. But you carried an authority with you that felt like it helped. It just made me, it felt like I could rest a little, actually. I felt like I could rest a little, because then I felt like if I feel a little overwhelmed, I feel like I can call you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely does. And I appreciate you saying that. I mean, honestly, I really think the Holy Spirit was a huge part of that, because there was almost this, it's hard to describe, but it was this like, almost like a righteous anger of like, enemy, you aren't taking this guy down, and you're not taking their family down. Like, you want to go? I'm ready.
Yeah.
Like, I'm gloves off. Here we go. It never crossed my mind that you weren't going to come out of this, yep, that you weren't going to conquer it. And that God wasn't going to do something really big.
And what's interesting too, Priscilla mentioned like, are getting involved in it, and Lisa's 8-ness, you know, bringing to the table. But we felt like up until that point, all of the updates that I got were either on a group text that Joey sent or through another person on our staff who was handling it and doing a good job with it. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we like got home and realized the severity of it, I'm a pretty good delegator. Like, I, you know, maybe to a fault, probably to a fault, but I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that this was our thing to lead. And mm-hmm. I told our team, I said, this is, Lisa and I are going to get involved. And if it goes, you know, if it doesn't go well, we'll take responsibility for it. But we just felt like, we were called to serve you guys during this time. And part of it was me knowing that I did have the authority to say, hey, don't worry about the job. We're not taking this to HR. This isn't an HR issue. This is like a health issue. And if we had somebody that was in a bad car accident and we knew it was going to be a long road to recovery, we're not going to bring HR to the hospital room to talk to them about that. We're going to...
Who cares? We don't care about what the job situation is. Like, we're going to figure it out.
And so we just felt like... And I knew having her at my side, like, I knew that we could... Because she's a bulldog. I mean, I don't know if we told you this, but she put on her calendar on her phone, and it came up every day until she just got a new phone a couple weeks ago. It drove me crazy. Every day, it was a reminder set every day, check on Joey and Priscilla. Mm. Like, popped up on her calendar, and it was like, you can't do that for everybody, right? But right. We knew that we were called to do it for you guys. And we did, there's a lot we couldn't help you with, we couldn't figure out, but it was like, we just knew we were supposed to get involved. So
you were very like bravely unafraid to stand with us. I will say, when you go through something that looks that scary, because he didn't, you know, he didn't look like him. You guys saw somebody at like something else. And so I could see that in people's eyes sometimes. Like, they would be caring, but like they looked scared. You know what I mean?
And that's,
and so then I have to be like, well, I'm not going to be scared, but to have somebody else walk in the room and not be scared with me was really important.
Yeah. The office, like I am curious, and I want y'all to be brutally honest. Like, what did you guys have the sort of reaction that Priscilla's, you know, like, was it kind of like, holy crap, like this dude is, because I mean, I that was the first time that y'all had seen me in that low of a state. I mean,
well, I'll speak from the non-medical background. Lisa's a physician assistant by education, so she probably had a little bit of a different perspective on it. But I left the office not freaking out, but one of the questions I asked Lisa on the way home is, I said, we've got to figure out if he's got any access to a weapon that could harm him.
Yeah.
Because I just realized you're in a really hard place.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like a, oh my God, what's, you know, but it was like, I hate to even verbalize this, but I'll feel really crazy and awful if I didn't mm-hmm. verbalize it. And so I think we just came home going, okay, he's not in a good place and he needs help, and we can't give him all the help that he needs, but he definitely needs, this is going to be, that's when she put the reminder in her phone.
Yeah.
That's when it was like, we are going to get involved as best as we can every day.
And I remember a look in your eyes where, if now looking back on it with kind of a more soundness in my mind, I'm guessing, like, was there a part of you that you just hoped that I would have like conceded to go to the hospital right then and there?
'Cause it 100%.
Yeah.
I wanted you to go in like immediately. Yeah. Mostly because, I mean, in my experience, even though my background was more emergency medicine, internal medicine, but I knew where you were. I knew that it was not in a good place. I think I found myself really frustrated because I walked out into the parking lot and made every phone call I knew to make, every connection that I had, and no beds were available. And it was incredibly frustrating to me because I am, you know, that eight cares about the, you know, injustice and underdog and whoever needs help. Like, you care mm-hmm. so deeply that you're like, what wall do I need to bust through? Mm-hmm. And I remember just feeling incredibly frustrated that our system was failing us mm-hmm. at that moment. And so I just desperately wanted for you to get the help that you needed right then, not in a few days, not having to go sit in the ER, not having to do all of that, but like a system that was going to like give you dignity and like where you could go and be cared for immediately. And that was so infuriating to me.
Agreed. Yeah. It felt like a full-time job trying to find the right help. I mean, I probably clocked at least 40 to 50 hours calling, researching, leaving messages. I think I had several appointments scheduled because if you're not a current patient, you have like a 2-month waiting period or something crazy like that to get into a really good psychiatrist that can help you with medication. And I was like, oh my gosh, like you can go to an ER and get help, but like you cannot, this is an emergency. And I could not figure out the right path. And it's, every time we talk about it, I feel like that is something I should probably be working on, even to the point when Joey was in the hospital. You visited him, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah. Have you been there before?
Yeah, I want to get
been there before.
Yeah, I want to get to that, but
I'm jumping ahead.
No, it's okay, Priscilla. It's okay.
I just was going to say, I wish even the environment in which you stayed gave more dignity. Have you been in there before? Oh my gosh.
I did a rotation there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it felt like I dropped Joey off in prison.
So it was a crazy summer full of depression and anxiety. As I was coming out of it a little bit in mid-August, I had some unfortunate crushing
situational explosions in my life. How's that for some dramatics? I remember being at some friend's house, Rebecca and John Basil, a night before a big hurricane was going to come through Charleston. Not a direct hit, or we probably wouldn't have been there. But we were playing cards, or excuse me, let me back up a little bit. As my wife was playing cards with them, I resorted to telling everyone that I was tired and I just reclined in a lazy chair, lazy boy chair. Of course, I had to be good friends with these two, and gosh, I'll never forget, just a little tribute to my friend. I never forget circling back around and saying, John, I'm sorry for how I acted. I was so depressed. And he literally said, we'll take you however we can get you. True, true friend. So next day, storm's rolling through. I remember watching Spanglish, a great Adam Sandler movie, laying down on my back with the kids, hoping they don't notice me, breathing heavy, just anxiety just spilling out of me. I remember standing at the sink washing something and Priscilla just trying to comfort me, and I just didn't know what to do. The next few weeks consisted of reaching out for help. I should specify my wife reaching out for me, but to no avail. This meeting with the Surratts, dear friends, and just no relief. I finally felt like I needed to concede to something I didn't want to concede to, and it was an outpatient program at a local hospital for people struggling, just similarly, kind of an all-day deal. So I showed up on a Friday, late September. There's a big difference between me and everybody else, though. They were laughing, smiling, interacting normally, going through the group activities with motivation, and I sat there and just went through the motions. Afterwards, there was a waiting room that I had to sit in for like 2 hours because part of the protocol was to be a part of this all-day outpatient program. You had to have an initial visit with the psychiatrist in-house that first day. Unfortunately, I couldn't meet with him for a couple of hours, so I just sat in the lobby, head between my knees for the most part, sobbing. And a dear nurse, probably my, you know, grandma age, came in there and said, hey, son, why don't you just come back to the room with me? Very dear woman, she just didn't want me out in the public crying and told me that she's seen many people in my condition and that she feels like I will eventually get better, but she realizes that this is hard. So when I finally talked to the psychiatrist, he told me that, hey, there's hope. There's some more extreme things that we can do, like ECT treatments, which I eventually did do. I think he was just trying to offer me hope, saying, hey, we haven't tried everything. So afterwards, I went across the street to a park, and I was simply mentally paralyzed. I didn't know what to do but just sit there and beg God for help. It was like the world kept going with people who could manage stuff, and I was there on pause, unable to manage a thing. Knew I needed to get back home, but was simply paralyzed, just sat there. So the following Monday, I reported back to this outpatient program, and about an hour and a half into it, I just thought to myself, I can't do this, and it's not doing any good. So I went to sweet grandma nurse's office, and I told her, I said, I can't do this, and I just wanted to make sure that she knew that I was leaving. She sat me down and she said, you know what? I really think you should check yourself in to the hospital. And at that point, I had nothing left. I didn't know what I was going to do. And I figured, okay, I'll do it. Something that I did not want to do. Okay, I'll do it. Now, she told me that she was going to try to pull some strings. And even though I did not have any substance that I was addicted to, she wanted to get me into the addiction wing, she said, because it would be a lot better for me not being with people who are suffering from schizophrenia and multiple personality disorders and those sorts of things. She was looking out for me, and she actually did pull that off. So she walked me to the emergency room, and I was kind of in one of those chair slash beds, just curled up, and I heard my wife's voice. She was checking in and wanted to be there with me, and I saw her break a little bit and heard her voice quiver when she saw me. The walk to the mental institution from the emergency room would have been humiliating for most people and for myself had I been in another state of mind, literally in hospital gowns, those almost paper-like slippers, and walking through a crowd of people, people on their lunch breaks, people walking to class. Priscilla was actually kind of offended by the inhumane treatment as she saw it, and I simply did not care. So we go into the institution, the hallway, the little area with rooms and a common area that I was going to be staying in, and the whole thing was so sterile. So back up a little bit, in the emergency room, they had a psychiatrist that was there to talk to people who checked themselves in the emergency room because of mental health issues. And she asked me if I was considering taking my life. My answer to her was, I can't do that to my kids. And I didn't know at the time, but that was enough for her to feel responsible and obligated to keep me there. So when I was in what would soon be my home for a week, I kind of walked towards where my room was going to be, and I couldn't believe it. There was no barrier between me and the other person. It just was like a bad, boring, dingy old college dorm room. And so I walked up to Priscilla and I said, I can't stay here. I changed my mind. Let's press the reset button. I'm not staying here. And she literally looked at me and she said, I understand. And so I approached that psychiatrist, and this was the only time that I felt really mistreated throughout this whole process. And honestly, humans are humans, and she probably just didn't have a whole lot of patience, but I just said, look, I don't want to stay here. I can't stay here. And she said, you know, this isn't criminal, but there was another terminology for it. But basically she said she's legally obligated to keep me here and that I didn't have a choice. And I pushed back a little bit more, and she restated her position. I pushed back one more time in desperation, and then she kind of flipped a switch, talked down to me as a child, and kind of stormed off. And I looked at Priscilla. I was like, does she not understand how hard it is? For the first time in my adult life, I do not have control over where I'm going to sleep tonight. So I'll say this about Priscilla, like, honestly, anytime this part comes up, like, she can't get through it without getting choked up. And I don't know exactly how it was said, but something along the lines of, you knew that Josh wasn't going to be able to come into the hospital, but he just decided to work in that area.
I probably still have it on my cell phone, but you said, I just want to be near. Like, you texted me and you were just going to stay there downtown because you were physically close to where he was.
Yeah. Yeah. When you guys took him, because you went through the ER, right? And I remember getting that phone call, or Marco Polo, whatever it was, that you shared that with Lisa. And I had been fairly recently in the same hospital where you were with another friend. And so I was like, I don't know how it works. I'm probably not going to be able to get in, but I'm just going to go down there and hang out downtown, and I'll study, work on whatever I got to work on. And if the opportunity comes up to get in, I'll go in. So, and I did, but I don't think I got in that day because you ended up staying
a week. It was a week.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird how reflecting on that time, like, there's some specific things that I remember, and then it's like little lighthearted memories, but then I realized just how deep, dark anguish I was. Like, I don't know if you remember, but it was something along the lines of, your car was parked outside of my window or something. And we weren't sure if that was my window or something like that, but you went outside, and I think we were maybe testing to see if you could see inside or something like that. And I remember that, and it was like a lighthearted moment, but like it you know, I think about it now and it's just like, oh my gosh, I was so much pain. I mean, it's just like, I am curious, like what was, you've got to remember how obsessed I was with losing the house. I mean, I talked to you about that probably two or three times, maybe more. I mean, when I would say stuff like that, like, did you recognize that's probably part of the sickness that he keeps talking about that? Or
yeah, and it wasn't just that. You talked about losing the house. There were a number of other factors going on in your life at that point.
Right.
And what I realized, especially at the hospital when we were talking, because I am a, like, if there's anything that God has wired me to do, it's to be hopeful. It's to give hope to people. Like if I had like a single word that would summarize what I feel like I'm supposed to do with my life, it's to help people be hopeful about the future. And it wouldn't work with you. It was frustrating because I'm like, you would talk about the house and your job and supporting the family. And I would be like, Joey, you're not losing your job. You're not going to lose your house. We'll figure that out. We'll pay you more. I was just like, I was lying, probably lying to you. But I was just trying to give you anything. But it was like any hopeful word that I said to you, it wouldn't register. Like it didn't stick.
Yeah.
But the stuff that was, you know, that was stressing you, it's all you could think about. And, right. You know, I'm not at all an expert in mental health, obviously. But maybe if there's somebody listening that has someone they love that's there, or that, but I do think that's, and you know a lot more about it, but I think you could just tell something's not clicking right, because what I'm saying is making sense.
Right.
What I'm saying should give you hope. It should help you to see, but it's not. And right. I could tell, I think leaving the hospital, I was never, again, I told you, I never wondered if you were going to get better. I knew that you were going to get better, but I was a little bit frustrated that I couldn't do it. You know, that my hopeful words weren't enough to get it done. But yeah. I knew that you were as dreadful as that place was. And as I agree with you, it's like, oh man, it reminded me of the movie with Robin Williams, Patch Adams.
Oh yeah.
You know, and yeah. It was like, you know, just a lot of people with varying levels of conditions down there. And it's very sterile environment. And, but I knew that it's where you were supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I knew that you'd get better at some point.
I know another big thing on my mind, because when someone falls into a depression like this, it's like the most important things are the stuff that you're most vulnerable with. And like spirituality is one of the most important things for me, or the most important. And then a lot of my baggage and upbringing and everything, it's almost like I had to self-sabotage and make sure you knew how crazy my beliefs were.
It is true.
Like you, I was just like, did. I think I actually said, dude, I feel more in line with Rob Bell. Like that's how bad it is, or something like that. And I mean, now with my more sane brain, like I'm fine at Seacoast. Like I, you know, we're enough on the same page. But at that time I was like, that's another factor, is I do not need to be here like this. And I want to be here and I shouldn't, like I'm being a liar to you. That's kind of how I felt.
And I was like thinking, Joey, I've heard your podcast. I know where you stand. I know how jacked up you are. And that's never scared me before. Not really jacked up. I know that you see things a little bit differently. But I have no question that we are brothers in Christ. We're moving in the same direction. And so for me, it was another one of those, just as much as the job thing. For me, it was like, that's not an issue, Joey. Like, just why do you keep bringing this up?
Yeah.
I know, I felt like you were exaggerating. You were trying to like prove to me that you were
right
out there to see if I was going to fire you. And again, I felt like I was in the emergency room with somebody with a head injury.
Right.
And that wasn't even registering to me as a valid conversation.
Right.
It was yeah. Like, why it was are we like talking that.
About your job?
Right.
You know, this is, and so, yeah, but I do remember you being obsessed about that. I remember thinking, I've known Joey for about 15, 16 years now. If he doesn't think I know,
right.
That he's a little bit different from me and certain theological things and certain, you know, that doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
That doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
You would say like you felt frustrated because you really are good at giving hope, which you are. And I know I've said this a bazillion times, but the hope and gratitude is what carried me for sure. And it is, I have my own testimony now to just how powerful hope is. I mean, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I couldn't, I agree.
I could not be yoked with anyone without it.
Yeah.
If you did not have hope for my husband, we can't work together.
Yeah. But you were thinking in your right mind at that point. You know, I think what I'm trying to say is that, and it's probably just a point of failure in the church's part, is thinking that what we have in Scripture and in Jesus is all that you needed to get better, but it wasn't. Because the brain that you have, and you said this when you spoke at a prayer service this year, you said that the organ with which God uses to for us to process our spirituality and our relationship with Him was broken. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where I was just like, man, this isn't working. You know, right. Like I can't help your brain. I can, hopefully get you in the right environment and whatever resources we can do, but I don't have the expertise. And I think it was a good thing for me to go, you know what, this is something that is going to require partnership of therapy and of medicine and of spirituality and of all of it. Cause my part wasn't helping.
And it's such, and I don't know if we even all realize how healthy of a culture Seacoast was in this area. But now I look back on it, I'm like, we have a pastor on staff, Chip, who's been on this podcast tons of times. He pastors the pastors, and he was okay with saying spirituality is not going to do you any good right now. I don't know if he told me that at the time, but when we've reflected on it, like, and you know, that's what I was trying to convey at that prayer service, is just like, you get to a place where it's just not going to cut it. And some people, I think that's offensive to some people, because it's like, well, God's bigger than everything. And it's like,
but
your brain can't process God correctly.
Well, and that He actually uses modern medicine to heal people. And I think that is a big challenge. I feel like there's a lot of people who have really strong faith that believe like, well, you have anxiety. Well, you just need to pray harder. Well, that's, what if you had a heart attack? Like, should we just not treat it? I mean, God gave us the tools, to be able to treat things, and you wouldn't feel ashamed about taking blood pressure medicine because you had a blood pressure problem. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't feel ashamed about getting a cast if your arm was broken. Mm-hmm. You know, that is something that I just think is so frustrating to me. It's like God, you know, gave us all of these tools, and, you know, it's the same. There's so much stigma and, with mental health that it's like, no. Your brain is just... it's sick,
right?
And we need to get you the medicine that you need to get it well,
right? Everybody in this room loves them dearly. Obviously, you guys way closer, so and not any sort of like talking point sort of way, but I do reflect on. I think about, especially with your eight, if all of this was happening post Darren losing his life, I kind of think he would have grabbed me by the shirt and said, "You are going to."
I would have escorted you personally to the ER.
I will call the cops. Like,
little tiny Lisa,
we will involuntarily admit you. Yeah. Pink papers.
Yeah, and I mean, Darren is the closest person to me that has lost his life to suicide. We've been in ministry for a long time. We've walked many families through this, and had it in our extended family. But in terms of somebody that I did life with on a day-to-day or at least week-to-week basis, that was the first person that I've ever lost to that. And so I think that, I think if that were to happen after that, I think I would know that all it takes is a moment, right? All it takes is the wrong moment at the wrong time. And so I think we would have done everything we could. And I still think we did.
I think you did.
A lot we tried, but it was like, in an unhealthy way, we would have probably tried to control something that was beyond our control.
Yeah.
Because you're afraid of losing somebody that you that you care about.
Well, it's interesting too, because Darren's passing really threw me for a loop, having gone through what I had just gone through, because I felt like, oh, now I understand suicide. I get it. I understand how people get to that point. And what I'm reflecting on was I was in hell day after day after day after day, and it just would get worse and worse and worse. And my thoughts would dig me deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And then I saw a guy teach on a Sunday, lead groups on a Wednesday, and then the next day's gone. And I was like, wait, that doesn't make sense. You know, I remember talking to Chip about that. Like, wait, I thought I understood suicide. That doesn't make sense to me. And, you know, obviously.
I think we all wrestled with that. Right. So, I mean, honestly, I think Josh and I both had many conversations just about like how did we not see it? How did we not? I mean, it just still to this day, we're just like, you know, with you, we're so grateful that you are willing to be vulnerable and say, I'm not good. Like, I can't tell you how thankful we are for that. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't know that with Darren.
Yeah. Well, and I had a conversation with Darren hours before he died, and he was engaged. He had ideas. He was presented some stuff for future message series. And I think what I learned through all of that is that mental health and depression looks different on different people. And because I walked with you through what I would say, you know, you were in a way worse place physically due to your illness. And Darren seemed to be very, you know, he seemed to be fine, but obviously
He buried it. And, you know, I just don't, he was not willing to, you know, really share where he was.
Right. Because I what he did the week leading up to his passing, I could not have done.
No, you couldn't have done
it. I couldn't even go to, I mean, I wasn't working, for crying out loud. Like, I wasn't even doing any part of my job.
You couldn't
much less
parent?
Teaching.
I mean,
like, yeah.
Yeah, you weren't living at your home. Right. You weren't. But I think, again, that to me, that just shows you that that there are lots of different facets to depression, to suicide. Yeah. We'll never know, right? Until we get to heaven one day, why Darren made the decision that he made and what he was thinking and where he was at. It could have been a passionate decision that he made at the wrong place at the wrong time, but it was very different than what you were walking through for sure.
So, obviously, medical professional here in Lisa, and then non-medical professional for the rest of us. When you, I think maybe the first time you saw me in a more healthier place, I think it was probably the Christmas party at the Mount Pleasant campus. At that point, are you at a place where, oh my gosh, I can't believe he made it on the other side? Or do you think maybe he shouldn't rush into his job? I'm worried that there'll be a relapse. I mean,
honestly, first of all, I remember seeing you guys at the Christmas party, and there were so many things happening at the Christmas party that were just so much fun, so good. There was nothing that made my night more than seeing you guys. I remember seeing you guys and just being like, thank you, Lord. Like, there is no more gratitude in my heart for anything else right now. I am just so, I just couldn't, it was just...
We could tell. I mean, seriously, it was on your face. So we could.
It was just, I mean, it was like a moment where it was like, okay, God, like, you're doing it. You're healing him. Because I knew that was a huge step for you guys to come.
That was really hard.
And and honestly, I do remember talking with the executive group and just saying, let's not let him go back too soon. Like, he needs a slow on ramp, like, where he is taking on a healthy pace, because it really was so important to me that you guys, you didn't feel like they've been waiting for me. That was never the issue. Not a single day. We were never like, hurry up, Joey. Never. We were like, you get well and you take on what you can take on in a healthy way. Mm-hmm. And as you feel like you need to, you're ready to take on more. Okay. But don't you feel an ounce of pressure?
No.
So that was where our, mindset was.
Yeah. And I think you know this, but Sam and I were at a barbecue restaurant when I was coming back. And, you know, obviously he was relaying a conversation from you, and they basically offered me a different job. I think I told you that, like just something that was less hands-on. Mm-hmm. And gosh, I just remember thinking, I don't want to do anything different than what I'm doing now. And I'm so happy that I can finally say that, you know?
Well, you and I had lunch at Panera Bread. Do you remember that?
I do. That was a little bit after I got out of the hospital, and little did I know the worst was yet to come.
Yeah. So I remember in that conversation trying to tell you, like, or just feel you out of what does Joey want to do? What's right. healthy for Joey to do? And I just remember you saying at that point, and again, I realized you had some worse days to come, but I remember you telling me, I really want to be with my James Island family. Like, yeah. I feel like that's who I'm supposed to, you know, be with. And it was like, okay, well, we'll figure that out. But again, yeah. I always felt like we could have it. We have enough people on our team to be able to help support. And obviously you guys, the campus was amazing. The people in the campus were super supportive of you guys, but mm-hmm. I always felt like, you know, I don't know how long it'll take, but once it happens, although I don't know that I would have said, I don't know if you've talked much about this, but since then we've actually given you more responsibility. It's pretty cool to think. And I don't know if this is the appropriate place to say it, but sometimes when you've had a testimony like yours, church word, you know, you've gone through something so terrible. I would hate for you to ever feel pressure that if you started to get into a tough place again, that right. you, well, I thought, yeah, you know, I was the guy that overcame that. I pray that you never have another day, you know, close to what you've had in the past. So I'm always sensitive to, like, dude, always come talk to us. But yeah. it is really, really cool to see you at a place where now you're leading at a higher level. You're leading, you know, more people, and you're doing it just so well, right. and you're caring for people well. And you scare me sometimes, though. I have to tell you this.
How so?
Well, we went out to Montana together with a group of people on our team, and we were going around a table on the first night, and it was just kind of a high-low, like, let's mm-hmm. talk about where we are. And I was sitting in a place where I could just see your profile, and you have a true RBF. I don't know if you know that.
RBF, I don't know what that means.
Resting bitch face.
Really?
Yes.
When you're not, when you're just kind of deep in thought, or you have a sad face on your, like, you just, it
you
looks
know
like
this.
Uh-oh,
when you
Joey's,
were a teacher, oh, yeah, you could just give a face and everyone's
or angry
scared of you.
Or, and so yeah. I was like, Joey's getting ready to share. I hope, I just was, I was worried. I was like, I hope he's okay. I'm glad we're out here if he's right. not. Based on your face, I was like, I am sure.
And at least you, we're out here in Montana.
And you shared, and you were like, man, I am in such a good place right now. Yeah. And you shared some about where you were, and you were like, I'm just, you know, I was like, oh, God. I was just happy. I was yeah. grateful. But your face wasn't saying that.
That's funny. That's funny.
It is yeah. true. He does that a lot. Like, that it's hard to read.
That Montana trip felt like a big hug from God, because that was when I was like, okay, I'm on the other side of this. And being able to spend time with you and your dad, and being in Montana, and just being able to jog in that area, ride boats and that, I was just like, I have my life back. And not only do I have my life back, I'm with people I love, and I'm in Montana. I mean, it just really felt like, this is just so awesome. And so it was an experience. People came and went. People were checking in. People who had been there for a week were checking out. I had various roommates. No phone. Couldn't keep up with my finances. Those who know me well, you knew that you would know that would stress me out. Couldn't keep up with my podcasts. I remember writing down notes of what my wishes were for the guys in Bad Christian, passing them off to Priscilla to pass off to them, of how I wanted them to handle my condition on the air. And just the whole being closed off, it turned from brutal restriction to safety and freedom. It was crazy. It was like knowing I couldn't do anything about anything. It was freedom. Now, sometimes I could live in this letting go freedom, and then other times my anxiety just wouldn't let me. But the bottom line, the brutal truth of not having control had some sort of positive effect on me for sure. I ordered food every day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. I'll never see hamburger patties without the buns and with cheese on it the same again. I was trying to eat low carb so I wouldn't get big and fat. There's group activities. I remember one of them, we were drawing a little phrase out of a hat and we would have to fill in the blank. It was just kind of a way of us talking and interacting. And this one guy pulled the paper out of the hat and said, I think the blank was something along the lines of, if I could change anything in this world, I would. And he filled in the blank by saying, I would have kept me from trying drugs once. And he just looked at all of us very serious and said, I wish I would have never tried it once. Next thing I know, my kids are out of the house and I was never a father, and now I don't know my grandkids. And just for a couple of minutes, it's like God gave me the ability to be a human again. And I remember walking up to him and saying, can I just give you a hug? He kind of looked at me a little confused. And I said, just what you said, man, really hit me. So we hugged. Priscilla visited me every day during the afternoon visiting hours. It was always a wild card what kind of Joey she'd encounter. Sometimes I'd be able to tell her how improved I had gotten that day, or just, you know, random getting better here and there. Other times I'd just cry uncontrollably, head in her lap. She was my rock, absorbing my pain, having her own, yet putting her own to the side because she knew mine was too much for me to bear. So every day I would meet with a psychiatrist who would check in on me, make some decisions with me on my medication. And I know a lot of nurses and doctors have the reputation for not being able to see humanity and just numbers, just patients. And I tell you what, there was a nurse there who I could tell the genuine disappointment on her face when basically one afternoon I told her I was feeling a lot better, and she checked on me the next morning and I told her I was back in my hell, and I could tell the look on her face. She was seriously, deeply disappointed. One of those meetings with the psychiatrist, I was told that I wasn't getting out before the weekend. I was anticipating getting out before the weekend, and I later found out it was greatly due to Priscilla's decision. She just wasn't comfortable with me being out. And I don't blame her. My family would drop off comfortable clothing that I would request, and they'd add some things that would make me feel less alone, pictures of my kids. There's one time where the group activity was going to see The Greatest Showman in another room, the movie, and I was like, hell no to that, because every single one of those songs remind me of my kids, and that would have just been too much to bear. I read a George Washington biography. I did some push-ups and leg lifts every other day. It was just something I could control, I guess. But this place, for the most part, it wasn't for the purpose of me getting better. It was simply to keep me safe. The chairs that we sat in to eat our food for meals weighed literally about 100+ pounds, so obviously people couldn't pick them up and throw them. There was no decorations or anything to warm up the rooms because they didn't want people being able to take curtains and hanging themselves. So partly the reason why it was so sterile. But here's the amazing thing is when it was time to go, that Monday, I was checked in on a Monday and I was checking out on a Monday. In my head, like my thoughts, I wanted to leave, but in my heart, I didn't. I actually was scared to absolute death. I did not want to leave. It was like my safe zone. Reminds me of Shawshank Redemption when that little short guy is petrified of the real world and ends up killing himself. And I'd later find out that I had really good reason to be scared, because the worst was absolutely yet to come.
what I'm curious of is, I mean, when's enough enough? Like, let's say it's, you know, right now we're podcasting is 2021 in March. What if I'm not better now? I mean, at some point, like seriously, like, and that was my number one fear. It's like when you feel that bad, you can't imagine getting better. And that was my worry. That's what I would tell Chip. That's what I would tell Priscilla. That's what I would tell my parents is like, why am I not getting better? Like, what in the world? Like, am I always going to be this way? I mean, see, cause, and my guess would be that you probably didn't think that far.
I didn't give it a lot of thought, but I did. I mean, there was a part of me that was like, okay, we should probably make contingencies for the people on James Island and be thinking about at some point, if Joey can't go back to James Island, that's okay. We're prepared to offer you another role that carries a different kind of a stress that's not maybe, but if it wasn't healthy for you, I was okay with that and thinking, yes, we're leading this church. We need to make sure that we're caring for the people that we're called to care for. But the thought of what if Joey doesn't get better really never sat with me very long at all, except for when you would say it. Because you said it to me in the hospital.
Yeah.
You're like, but what if I don't?
Right.
Like, what if I don't get better?
Yeah.
But I just didn't really entertain that very much. And we also, you know, I knew that we have very generous people that if it got to the point where you were disabled long-term because of this illness, we'd find a way to take care of your family and make sure that you guys were okay between what the government offers, between what Seacoast would offer, between what I'm positive that people at your campus would go, I will help, you know, like, so I just knew that the scenario of, well, we're going to fire Joey, that was never on the table.
Yep.
That was never like, we're going to have to let him go and, gosh, I hope they figure that out. You know, that was never in our thoughts.
And there it was
a really obsessive thought of yours.
Oh, I remember, gosh. I mean, all of this stuff was just plaguing me every second of every minute.
You would say you didn't think about it until you would say it. Well, he was saying it to me all the time. And I remember, do you remember, I don't know if we ever podcast about this, but we have a really big closet, like way too big for a bedroom. And he would, when he was really bad, which was a lot, he would lay in the dark in the closet. And so I would go in there. I would get the kids squared away with whatever. And I'd go in there and you would say, we should just sell the house and move. I don't know. We were going to move to Iowa or something. That's where I'm from. I'm like, I don't have any close. I mean, I have family there, but like, what do you mean? Like, we're not going to do that. And you were relentlessly, like you were trying to convince me that we really had to just give up.
Start all over.
You were like trying to get me to sell things and give up and just get rid of everything because we had to go. Do you remember? I actually like got on top of him and I like looked at him like what you said, like the fierce, like we're not doing this. I was like, we are not selling the house. We are not moving anywhere. You are going to get better. I was almost like, in the name of Jesus, this is not happening. Like what you're saying is not normal, but you just did not have normal thoughts. You were obsessed with not being able to support the family.
Let me ask Joey a question. Cause like I'm listening to you, Priscilla, when we would say stuff like that to you, Priscilla would say stuff like that to you, like, no, we are not quitting. We are going to get better. Was it helpful?
It's absolutely white noise. Just absolutely white noise. It didn't. I remember you and I riding around the neighborhood and we have Chip on speakerphone and it did not matter what in the world you guys said. I mean, they were just like, I mean, just trying so hard to get into my head and it didn't matter what they said. I knew the doom and gloom was real.
What if they had agreed with you?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I really don't know. I guess what I'm getting at is what would you tell somebody who's talking to you in your worst moments? What would you tell them? And I love what you're saying. You're being real honest. It's white noise, but I just wonder what's helpful, what's not, when you have a loved one who's walking through.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good question as far as like, what if they agreed with me? I would say maybe there would be like an immediate sense of, finally, I got through to them to make them see it. But that would not have been helpful for them to come down to me. So I guess even though it was white noise to my brain as far as like whether or not it would help me, it did not help. I think bird's eye view, them keeping hopeful was still putting hope in my life, whether I could feel it or not.
Because I think it was hopeful. I saw that it was. It would be helpful to you. But the reason it wouldn't be helpful is you had no relief of your anguish. So it was helpful. It was a relief to know you were accepted for who you were. It was a relief to know, to feel real deep, true love and hope and all of that, deep friendship. But how can you enjoy it if you can't get out of your anguish?
Yeah. Hmm.
Can I just say real quick, I watching you, Priscilla, and the many, many conversations that we had, the strength that you had in that season in caring for your kids and caring for Joey and whole, like, it was, it honestly built my faith so much to watch God carry you through that.
Yeah, it was definitely God.
Because you never wavered. Even on your worst days, you never wavered. You still believed that God could do it, that Joey was going to get better. And I mean, it was just incredible to watch.
And that's why anyone with any other attitude different from you guys with hopeful, she could not have in their life. I mean, in her life. Like, if you're not, like Priscilla said, if you're not going to bring hope to the table and belief, that kept her sanity. Like, she never wavered, ever. Like, it was, he is going to get better. I'm not going to entertain anything else. And I don't understand, other than God, how you didn't come to at least some breaking points where you're just like, I guess things just aren't going to get better.
I don't have anything profound to say, except I don't think it was me. I just don't. I mean, we talk about basic parenting stuff or things that are hard for my heart, or I'm just sitting here like, I don't know what to do next. But then that is way bigger and way harder. And that just wasn't me. It was kind of miraculous, I guess.
In the natural sense of things, most people would break under some of that pressure. I'm sure you had days that you felt like you broke, but it was like, no, she's emotional, health in a healthy way. She's not denying the reality here, but she's continuing to constantly point towards the future and point towards solutions and what's next. And so it was pretty cool.
I mean, if you think about it, though, that's really sweet of y'all to say that, like, it's me, but it's not. I mean, like, God gave me the perfect job for my personality during that time. I worked a front desk at my kid's school, and it was insanely busy there. So it kept me feeling productive and useful all day long and distracted. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm interacting with the public all day long. And then people like Jack Hoy would talk to me in the morning sometimes on the way to work, because I didn't have any margin of time. Because when I was at work, I didn't have any breaks, hardly. And then after work, I'm with my kids, you know? And so, I mean, when you were in the hospital for a week, his name was Dr. Lewis. He figured out what my schedule was, and he would call me at 7:15 in the morning on my ride to work. I would have Gwenny put her AirPods in her ears so she would have music, and then I would talk to him on the way to work for my 20-minute update on how Joey was doing. I mean, it's just like, I had an amazing doctor that was caring for Joey in the hospital. I had you guys that had the immense amount of hope and fierceness that were like, we're getting through this. And I had this amazing campus family and my sister, and even our kids were amazingly resilient and just how they were there for each other. You know what I mean? And his parents and my parents. And I mean, I just, sometimes I feel really I almost can't think about it. Like, what do people do when they don't have all that I had? You know, I had a lot. I didn't just have me and my strength, you know? I had a lot around me. Some people don't have that. And that is a really dark place, you know? There's a lot of beauty in our life still. You just couldn't see it yet.
I also want to point out the difference between my last comment and Lisa's. It just shows you pretty much the types. So she is the Christian in the relationship without question.
Hey, man, I brought a football. You didn't even want to talk about it.